in keeping with our efforts to start this committee as close to on time as possible, I will call the meeting of the Energy Finance and Policy Division to order. First on the agenda today, first on the agenda, I guess, would be the approval of the minutes, if anyone's had a chance to peruse them. Representative Dornis, since you pointed out that you were here ahead of time, perhaps you had time to...
According to my watch, anyway, but the minutes look terrific. I move the minutes.
Representative Dornis moves approval of the minutes from January 26th. Any additions or corrections?
You mentioned the 26th. It shows the 28th on my minutes.
Thank you. The 28th. My mistake. Any other additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of their approval, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, we have to begin with the continuation of the agenda from the meeting on the 28th, in which we ran out of time for the presentations from Director Glahn and Ms. White. If you're prepared to conclude your presentation, please go ahead and do so.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much for allowing us to conclude. As you recall, we had just finished with the presentation of Janet Streff, who's the manager of the State Energy Office, and that did not have time to begin the presentation of Mariah White, who is the manager over our regulatory and energy permitting efforts at the department, at the Office of Energy Security, part of the department.
And so, Mr. Glahn, we do need to have you identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize, Mr. Chair. Bill Glahn, I am the Director of the Office of Energy Security and a Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Commerce.
Thank you.
And with that, I'll turn it over to Ms. White.
Ms. White, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Mariah White, Manager of Energy Regulation and Planning and Energy Facilities Permitting. Running out of time last week and starting off with this is kind of auspicious because you'll get the entire picture of state energy regulation in one shot. That leads me to the first slide. I wanted to just convey what Ms. Wells, when she gave a telecom talk last week, talked about. Minnesota has chosen to have what's called a split commission. Some states have this. Iowa has it. Many states do not. They have a combined commission. Wisconsin has a combined commission. What I mean is that Minnesota has chosen to split out the analytical and advocacy parts of the analysis of commission filings from the advisory part to the commissioners. In many states, that's all in one filing, and the staff informally splits themselves into a type of ex parte wall to protect the commissioners. Minnesota's taken that a step further to ensure that the commissioners are protected from ex parte situations by splitting us off into another state agency. But because of the way you broke us up last week, you'll see my analytical advocacy part, and then you will also hear from Dr. Haar, who is executive secretary of the commission. So you'll also hear about the advocacy part, or the advisory part. So the whole part together, the two parts together, make up all of the work of the Public Utilities Commission and state energy regulation. The three parts that are in my area are the regulation and planning, energy facilities permitting, which is a separate function, and the state reliability administrator staff. And we'll go over each of these separately. energy regulation and planning is the analytical and advocacy part of the information for the commission. Our charge by statute is to advocate for the public interest in state as well as regional as well as federal energy forums and actions. We also have a charge, more of a policy charge, but nevertheless very important because it's a policy, I think, of the state, to advocate for energy-related actions and policies that promote reliable, environmentally sensitive, and reasonably priced energy for our citizens and our customers. Now, that sounds easy, but it's not. Because if you think about it, reliable energy may not or may be environmentally sensitive. For example, wind energy, as you know, the wind doesn't blow all the time. Wind energy, when it blows, is very reliable energy. But when the wind stops, we can't call on it if we need the energy. So that's two kind of opposing things. Another situation is sometimes reliable information or reliability information or energy or environmentally sensitive energy may not be the cheapest form of energy for a customer. So we have to balance all three of these policies and actions for the best interests of the state. I put up this slide just to show you a little bit about or explain to you a little bit about the type of things we look at. Now, the list of numbers by itself doesn't mean much, I know, but I wanted to point out, for example, the first three categories: rate cases, resource plans, and certificates of need. All of these cases are very big cases. They usually involve anywhere from 4 to 8 staff witnesses, as well as 1 to 2 attorney general attorneys. They go before an administrative law judge. The staff as witnesses, who are considered expert witnesses for the state, file pre-filed written testimony, usually 2 to 3 rounds of this. Then they get on the witness stand and they have to defend their testimony. And this is just like any other civil case where they have cross-examining attorneys. They cross-examine. Sometimes it gets pretty tense. Sometimes it gets a little bit on the nasty side. But they are our expert witnesses. They have to have the credentials. They have to have the expertise to defend the state. We are the defense on behalf of the state in such matters. And that is why when you had the first overview by Commissioner Wilson, and he talked about a certain number of the staff in the agency have higher education degrees or graduate degrees or postgraduate degrees, the majority of those people are in my area as well as the telecom area. We have to have credentials. All of us have a master's degree and above. We have a number of PhDs. We have JDs. And all of our accountants are CPAs. We have to have those educational credentials in order to sponsor or be witnesses for the state against very high-powered, very expensive consultants that the utilities and stakeholders bring to the witness stand. Rate cases, as you know, are basically a general audit of all of the costs of a utility. So our CPAs go through, do a very detailed audit of all of those costs, and that forms the rates that are charged to customers. Resource plans, and this gets to a question, Representative Knuth, that you asked last week about who does planning for energy resources. This is resource planning. What this is we forecast, based upon all information, including from the state demographer, what customers will need into the future for the next at least 15 years or going forward that we know of within the realm of information that we know. We then take those forecasted needs and we look at the generation sources that we have or expect to be in that general time period, and then we balance the two and see if we're short energy or if we're long energy or exactly what we need, and then we make recommendations. We always, in all of our resource comments and recommendations that we make, always plan that the utility will fully comply with their SIP 1.5%, and they will fully comply with their RES obligation. Those two things go first before we look at anything else. Certificates of need come in where any time a utility or any stakeholder wants to build a large energy facility, we're talking about any kind of power plant, transmission line, pipeline, anything like that, statutory definition of large energy facility. They have to go through a process that identifies whether it is needed by the state and the utility's customers, and whether it's the best option to fulfill whatever that need is. So it's a two-step part. These are very highly controversial, complex proceedings, and we have a number of them, and we're going to see more in the future. So that's what a certificate of need. The first thing they have to have before they can go forward to look at where they put it, the siting and anything, they have to have a certificate of need approved by the commission. Now the rest of these categories that I will just show you are general categories. You will notice for energy adjustment, we have 194 filings. That is the cost and the usage of the actual energy itself, both natural gas and electricity, that customers use. Every utility has to file monthly reports, they file quarterly reports, they file annual reports. We look at every one of these when they come in, we analyze them, we file reports with the commission, we contest some areas of it. These can be very highly controversial filings, because this is the biggest part of any utility deal is the energy itself, no matter if it's natural gas or electricity. And I will stop there. Now we'll go on to energy facilities permitting. This is a different part of the statute. What this is after a large energy facility gets a certificate of need, the commission approves one, so they have it. Now they have to figure out where to put it physically in the state. There are a number of separate statutes and separate federal laws that come into play here to look at the environmental impact. And when I say environmental impact, I mean not only the environment itself, air and water, but land use, social aspects, cultural resources aspects, wildlife aspects, protected species aspects. There's any number of categories that fall within the definition of environmental impact. So we have separate staff that are housed physically in a separate part of the agency who work in the energy facilities permitting, and there is a lot of public process that goes into this. Multiple hearings, multiple meetings with the public to ensure that anyone potentially impacted by the potential placement of any of these large large energy facilities has the opportunity to know what's going on and to comment and to provide their impact in this. So we have people on the road all the time, all over the state, in meetings and working with general landowners and impacted parties with these processes. Here's projects for the energy facility permitting. Completed projects in 2008. I put in two columns of numbers here just to give you an impact. What's important with this is you can see that between 2008 and our first month or a couple months, of 2009, transmission lines and wind conversion systems are really, really coming into play here. We're getting lots of filings. We're working on lots of projects. And we believe that we're going to see this level for quite a long time. The RES has a lot of wind projects in place for to enable utilities to comply with the REF. And it doesn't do any good to build wind turbines if you don't have transmission available to deliver that energy to where it's needed. So we are seeing a lot of action in the energy stability permitting area. The last part I will just talk about briefly is the Reliability Administrator. The State Reliability Administrator has its own statute, and basically the gist of it is to provide technical expertise related to the reliable delivery of energy. The legislature, have seen fit to ask the Reliability Administrator to take a number of studies, which we are in the process. We either have completed and filed with the State Research Library, or we are in the process of. I will note that Representative Falk last week asked me about one of those studies, and I have to admit when he asked me about it, it didn't ring a bell, so we went back and researched. And it was a study related to looking at what other states have done about either state-owned or state-authorized transmission. We did a study seeking or researching every other one of the 49 states to see what they have done. We wrote it up in a study that I think we sent to Mr. Pomeroy last week, but I have a hard copy here. We also have 8 megabytes of backup information, which I think is 182 pages, which we have a copy of if you would like it. And that was filed with the legislature and the research library in February 15th of 08. So that is available if you care to look at it. One of the largest, probably the largest study that the Reliability Administrator is working on right now is a dispersed renewable generation study. This was a study that basically looked at inventorying all of the grid of the state, the smaller voltage and the larger voltage grid of the state, to identify areas that perhaps have some open capacity at specific places where a wind turbine or a small energy project or a small biomass, for that matter, could be sited, and sited fairly easily without big impact to the grid. Phase one of that project was done on schedule, June 15th of 08. We had a webinar to provide those results around the whole state. We had over 250 people on the webinar. We have found out that we identified almost all the sites were in southeastern Minnesota, because every other part of the state, southwestern Minnesota, where you think on the Buffalo Ridge, and the rest of the state, we found were so constrained, transmission constrained, that we couldn't find any sites. So southeastern Minnesota got the first 600 megawatts, and I will tell you that most of those megawatts are tied up. Are basically you could say claimed, and are in the process of interconnection proceedings and things like that on the federal level. We are now into phase two of that study. It is due later this year, where we will identify another 600 megawatts around the state. I will tell you the two main takeaways from phase one report. Is that the fact that I mentioned already, every part of the state is transmission constrained except for the southeast part. And even the sites identified in the southeast part of the state impact the grid. Everything that transmission engineers identified impacts the grid to a certain extent. It might not be a huge amount, but everything does, because everything is integrated. And I see Representative Falk moved his microphone over.
Thank you, Ms. White. And before we get to Representative Falk, I have Representative Beard on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. White, two questions. Refresh our memory on the difference between small generation and large generation, so we know what the cutoff is for your research purposes.
Ms. White.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, it depends on the type of large energy facility.
Oh, so.
yeah, It depends if it's like, let's say like wind turbines. We have for the siting part of it, anything under about 25 megawatts where we are working with local units of government versus state for siting authority. We are in the process of working with them to see if perhaps some of the counties wish to site projects under 25 megawatts. We're working with them to ensure that their siting authority meets all the provisions of state law, and then they will be able to legally site projects in their county rather than having the proposer go to the state to site that. So that's one deadline. That's one limit, you might say. Yeah. Let's see. If I remember correctly, and if I don't, I'll make sure and go back, Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, and check these. Because I'm drawing a blank right now, but I will say that anything over 10 miles of transmission line and over 100 kilovolts, so it's 115 kilovolt line over 10 miles, must go for a certificate of need. And on the siting side, basically anything above no matter how small a voltage it is, so it could be a 69 kV line, anything above, if I remember right, 4 miles,
mm-hmm.
anything above just a little interconnection from a substation or for something needs to be sited, needs to go through the siting process.
Representative Beard.
Ms. White, thank you, Mr. Chair. What about generation? If someone wanted to burn corn cobs, for instance, or found a hydro dam they could work, or some... How large can they go before they have to come from the PUC for a certificate of need?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, it's usually 50 megawatts.
50 MW.
Right.
One last question on this, Mr. Chairman. On the sweet spot study, the generation thing we talked about,
mm-hmm.
did that assume that generation would remain static, or did it take into account the effects of the CapEx 2020 program that's being implemented?
That's right.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, it took into account, I have to remember the timing, that's why I'm hesitating. I know it took into account the proposed Big Stone transmission line because that was already in the regulatory process.
Okay.
When we started phase one, of the dispersed renewable generation study, CapEx had not been filed for a certificate of need yet. I think it's in there, but I need to come back. I need to go back and check for sure.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. That'll do for now. But I think we have another phase of this report coming up here shortly. I can wait for that. That'd be
yeah.
fine.
Thank you, Representative Falk.
A couple questions on that. I mean, part of what the details of that study were based on what you think the power and what you turn off, what you turn on, and being that we think most things in the southeast metro area. That's why the results came out as they did, but if my memory serves me correctly, the only area that was completely transmission constrained was the northwestern transmission zone as a result of the Dorsey substation issue, which, I mean, that's had an issue for multiple line proceedings, so I don't know if that's maybe a fair thing to put strictly on this report, but I know that there was some in the southwest and south and west central where we did find places where we could inject power as a result of that study. Specifically 20 megawatts at Atwater, which I would consider to be West Central.
Ms. White?
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Falk, I think it just depends on how much you want to impact thrift. I think what we looked at was trying to impact the grid with basically not having to spend any money
mm-hmm.
for having to shore up surrounding facilities around there. And going into the southwestern part, it was more likely that we were going to have to do some shoring up of surrounding grid to or substation something along those lines in order to be able to site things. So you are correct. We could have included that, but we were trying to do it spending the least amount of money that we possibly could with having to shore up the surrounding area or interconnecting, impacting area.
Mr. Long.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fogg, my recollection, Ms. White, of the study, just correct me if I'm wrong on this, was we were trying to optimize two things at once. We were trying to find those 600 megawatts, those sites that had the least or zero transmission interconnection costs, and also find projects dispersed throughout the state. And it turns out the bulk of them were in the southeastern part, but pains were taken to find at least a couple of sites wherever we could throughout the state, even though they might not have ranked as high as some other ones that didn't make the list.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Paul, that is correct. And we've got the next 600 that they're just now starting to look at again. The group's formed. They are starting, the transmission engineers are going back to the drawing board and looking at that. So we will have to see what they come up with for the next round.
Representative Beard, any other questions?
I do. This is a great discussion, and she's spurred a couple more questions. When you say we, Ms. White, we need to invest or we don't want to have to invest in order to make this work, who's the we we're referring to here?
Ms. White.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, it could be anyone. It could be the utility or utilities who own facilities around wherever you're talking about, wherever that interconnection point is. It could be any transmission owner or someone who would want to invest in transmission who might want to build some facilities. It could be any number of entities. And the reason that I say that is because we have, what's their call? I think it's Interstate Transmission something, ITC, Interstate Transmission Corporation. They are a transmission-only corporation that are in Minnesota. They're not a public utility. They don't provide retail service to anyone. All they do is they build transmission lines and they deliver wholesale electricity to retail, you know, munis, co-ops, or regulated utilities. They're FERC regulated, actually, federally regulated. And an entity like that might want to come in and build some facilities.
As Ms. Chairman, Ms. White, as we speak of the planning aspect, and some of there was a question about that the other day, and you've expounded a little further on it, we commissioned this sweet spot study and spent some money here getting that done, but doesn't MISO have something like this already going on? Don't they know where the capacity in the grid is and where it's constrained, and don't we hear from them all the time that we need to be a little more careful in where we site generation, and if customers are going to just put load wherever customers want to put load, we need to react to that somehow?
Mm-hmm.
Do we kind of reinvent the wheel here, or talk a little bit about that relationship if you can? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's right.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, I think that's just an excellent question, and we're not reinventing the wheel. We're inventing the wheel. You are correct, everything you said about MISO. You are correct that they are looking at this, but they are looking at the large levels of transmission. They're looking at the mostly 115 kV, 230 kV, 345 kV size, the big transmission line. What we did in the dispersed renewable generation was we looked at the small grid, the small retail grid. MISO does not do that. MISO looks at the large area. And the study that you commissioned the RA to do actually had never been done before by any state. It was inventing the wheel. And we thought it was very successful. It was very interesting to get this study off the ground because transmission engineers for each of the utilities had to be involved. Transmission engineers always protected their grid. It was their grid. They built it, they planned it, they operated. It was their grid for their utility. Now all of a sudden they had to work together. It was a new way to do things, and they had to change their thinking. So we had to do some directing to start with. But once they understood exactly the benefits and what was at stake, they just pitched in and did just a wonderful job working together. They also provided information to each other that had never been provided before. For security purposes, some of it was confidential during the time of the study, and they were willing to do that. So this was groundbreaking, and a lot of states around the country have watched it very carefully what was going on, and now there's other states looking at doing it as well.
Thank you,
Representative Saul. With the second phase of this study coming up, and it's dependent upon which facility you take out of operation to replace with other locally dispersed generation. What made sense in the first study was to take out those sinks or those generating facilities, mostly natural gas facilities in the metro area. Is there some look at focusing more on some of those natural gas peaking or other smaller facilities in the outstate regions, which will ultimately change the way that we look at which sites should be built and where we should site some of these dispersed or distributed generation projects, as we look at this as both a reliability tool but also as an economic development tool for parts of the state that aren't exactly metro.
Mr. Chair, Representative Falk, I don't know if they took any natural gas plants out of commission when they did that, because natural gas is a natural load follower to wind. When the wind dies down, then natural gas is probably about the only type of generation that can start fast enough to follow the decrease in energy when the wind dies down. So natural gas is a natural backup fit for wind. I wasn't sure. You absolutely could be correct. I'd have to check. I didn't remember doing that. I don't know if we took natural gas plants in outstate out of commission, if that would make that much difference. I think the transmission engineers will look at it.
Well, that was kind of the premise of the first study, is we were looking at how we could supplement 600 megawatts of existing generation with locally dispersed generation. Not that we took it offline, but we went and took some of those power sinks, places where we had generation, and we replaced that with dispersed generation to fill the gap to where we could be dynamic. And those places that we took out of the study were in the metro area primarily. Now, as a result, that's why the southeast, came back as the primary spot to do the development, because we replaced generation in those areas primarily. Now, if we replace the generation or the peaking plants in other regions of the state, it's going to change the results of the study to make development in those parts more favorable. So I'm just asking, is there some push to look at having a more dispersed set of inputs going into this second phase of the study to maybe distribute the projects throughout the state more?
That's fine.
Mr. Chair, Representative Falk, I think so. I think they're going to take another look and see if they can't disperse it more around the state and to change the flow patterns and to change the sinks and to see what they can come up with. Because I don't think they're expecting that they're going to find another 600 megawatts in any one portion of the state. I think they think that they need to go and try to disperse as much as they can around the rest of the state.
Ms. White, do you have more?
Actually, Mr. Chair, that's the end of my talk. Thank you very much.
Thank you, members. Are there further questions for Ms. White at this time? Seeing none, thank you.
Mr. Chair, if it would please the committee, I'd like to bring Tim Janke back to give an overview of the Department of Commerce's budget. That was something that we were put on the agenda for today, and we have a little bit of a time constraint here. And Mr. Janke, as you recall, is the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Commerce, covers all of the departments, not just the Office of Energy Security. But before we get to his presentation, don't hit the button. Before we get to his presentation, I wanted to call to your attention We are revamping the energy portion of the Department of Commerce website. You'll recall from our earlier discussion of the department that it turns out that most of the visitors to the department's website are seeking energy-related information. So we've taken a couple of whacks at making our website more energy or more user-friendly, more providing more information and more being more useful to the general public when they come onto our website looking for information. So we've got a couple of screens here. Not particularly readable from across the room, but just I encourage members to log onto our website. And about 2 weeks from now, we should have the new version up and running and hopefully helping people out even more than our old site. So with that, I'll turn it back to Tim.
Mr. Glenn, before you do that, who's Mr. Phil?
It's Phil Smith. He's one of my staff people, and he, when you call the information Energy Information Center, he's really the guy who answers and has all the information. And we decided to put a face, and actually, this is a really good likeness of him. I'm not sure how flattering you find it,
but it's a really good likeness of it.
So, Director Glenn, you're telling us that the state actually has a website in which it's possible to reach. Through which it's possible to reach a human being,
and not only is he walks, he talks, and he answers difficult and complex questions about energy. So yes, Mr. Chair, it is true.
Excellent.
Believe it or not,
we're really glad to hear that. Mr. Janke, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Tim Janke, Budget Director for the Department of Commerce. I'll walk through, the department has four change items that we didn't talk about last week that were announced in the interim. I'll go over them. If there's kind of detailed questions that the members have, we may need to get somebody out of the crowd here to explain them in a little bit more detail. The first item I'll mention here or talk about is in the market assurance area, the proposal to recover costs for doing some of the investigative work that we're doing. Currently, this work is done through the use of contractors, and the money is basically a pass-through. What this proposal is to move that function in-house to allow staff that we'd add some staff in our agency, we'd be able to do these investigations cheaper than the contractors are currently doing them. We'll increase expenditures by approximately $680,000, increase revenues by $754,000, and also we'll do some other decreases in the workers' comp area. It's about a 10% reduction in the appropriation we received from the workers' comp fund, and shift some funding, some work that's currently being done, that we can charge some of that workers' comp to the insurance fraud prevention account. So that's the first proposal in the governor's budget. The second one is for product review and registration changes. What this would be is to move those filings to file and use, which means that there isn't the pre-approval or the work isn't done on the front end. Companies are filing. They're able to begin selling those products. These are selected products. And then we reserve the right to go back and review them on the back end. What this would do is decrease our general fund expenditures by about $300,000 for FTE reduction. So between these two proposals, we have approximately an 8 FTE increase in the first one and a 4 FTE reduction on the second one. And it nets about $374,000 in savings to the general fund. Move on to the next change items we have here. In the Office of Energy Security, this proposal, currently there is a portion of the Office of Energy Security General Fund budget that is not recovered through the assessment on the regulated industries. this proposal would increase or allow us to recover those costs, approximately $284,000 a year. This would be revenue to the general fund. It would these non-regulatory costs. The kind of the rationale behind it is that these activities really support the regulated industries and the assessment or the portions of the budget that we currently do assess to those regulated industries. And the last change is in the administrative services area. This is a decrease of $411,000 in the general fund. We've moved that's approximately 6.5 FTE to kind of soften the blow for the administrative area. We would move 3 FTE to our indirect cost account, which with basically we're able to charge on our federal funding indirect cost rate. And with the kind of large increase in the federal funding that we've seen already and we're expecting to see, that account will be able to handle a few more employees. So we'll move 3 over to there, and then we'll have about a 3.5 FTE reduction in other areas in our admin. Could affect some of our HR functions and our general support functions, mail room, front desk, those types of things. So we're working to make that kind of create those efficiencies and do some things that will make us more efficient in those areas so that those reductions don't affect us too much. It will. We're hoping that those reductions don't result in any actual layoffs. We have some folks who are nearing the retirement age, and just through general attrition, we're hoping that we can meet that 3.5 FTE in this proposal.
Before you move on, Mr. Yep. Yankee, Representative Beard, I think, has a question.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Beard.
Mr. Yankee, back to the assessment for non-regulatory costs. Mm-hmm. I understand you're going to assess the people we regulate for that, about $284,000?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, yes. We currently assess the Office of Energy Security's general fund budget is almost wholly assessed to the regulated industries currently.
Mm-hmm.
There's a small portion, $284,000, that isn't assessed right now, and this proposal would be to assess both costs.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Beard,
can that be passed through then to the ratepayers? That's where that comes from?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, yes. I mean, I think ultimately the companies probably do pass that through.
And last question on that line, Mr. Chair.
Representative Beard.
The municipals and the cooperatives also, are they subject to that assessment?
Yes. Mr. Chair and Representative Beard, yes.
They're considered regulated for this. Okay, thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a couple questions on the change items. The first is on the administrative services, and I'm looking in more detail, and it says you'll likely terminate your new employee orientation program. And we've heard, and not so much in the Commerce Department, because you've been held up as an example of a department that's doing a great job on internal controls and following where the money goes and all of that. But I'm curious what a new employee won't be getting in terms of being hired at the Commerce Department, or if you are hiring new employees. I mean, sounds like you're losing some, maybe hiring others. What won't they be learning?
Mr. Jenkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knuth. Just kind of as a little bit of background on the employee orientation program. It's about a half day orientation to the department, kind of a little bit more detail than where the restrooms are, kind of going over policies, procedures, getting a little orientation about what the different areas of the department do. For instance, Deputy Commissioner Glahn might come in and do a 5-minute, if the employees aren't from his area, come in and talk to them about what the other areas of the department do. I don't think we will be giving up on getting information to the employees that they need to do their job. They won't be left We'll make sure that they're still getting the policies and procedures, that they're still getting the information, but it's more on a they'll be reading that information on their own versus having an interactive discussion with it. They can still get that information by working with our HR office and others if they need it, if they have questions, etc.
Representative Atkins or Representative Knudsen, do you have a follow-up?
I, Mr. Chair, I had another question, but not on this issue. If you want Representative Atkins to go first, that's fine. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious in your budget and how it's reflected, or if it's not, if it'll be kind of standard duties of how you're preparing or will be working to administer any funds we might be receiving through the from the federal government with the Recovery and Reinvestment Act.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we've had some preliminary discussions with primarily Deputy Glahn's area, and I've also had a brief discussion with the department, Minnesota Management and Budget now. We'll need to, I guess, on my side of the shop, if we're getting additional federal monies, we'll be working with MMB to, fill out all of the appropriate paperwork and get the request in so that the legislature can approve the spending of those monies. And I guess as far as the administration of it, beyond that, we have our infrastructure set up. I mean, we can receive the money, we can get it in the door. I think the bigger part of it is in Deputy Glahn's area is to figure out how to get it out in an appropriate fashion and do that well.
Commissioner Glahn.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knuth, and we have put together an internal working group that includes Janet Stress, the manager of our state energy office. Jeremy DeFebri, who is sitting over there, who works for Janet, is also involved to try to put together a plan for how to not just intake the money and get it out again through our programs, but to put it to productive use and make sure we get the most out of the taxpayer money, whether it's state or federal.
Representative Atkins, yes,
thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Junkie. On the file and use piece, just to make sure that I got my head around what that proposal to save $300,000 would do. Right now in Minnesota, if an insurance company wants to sell any kind of product, they would have to come run it by you folks. You review it, you make sure that it's appropriate to be sold, and then you approve it, and then they can sell it. Under the governor's proposal, the insurance companies instead would be able to go out and sell whatever they want to, and then 12 times a year or 12 times quarterly, you all would pick one of the products that they're selling and decide, you'd take a look at it, see if it was really appropriate. First off, I want to make sure that that's actually what's taken place, and then the second issue would be how many products are brought before the Commerce Department on an annual basis that right now need to be approved and blessed and before they're sent out. I kind of suspected you'd be up at the table for this, Manny.
Mr. Munson-Vergala.
Chair, Representative Atkins, Manny Munson-Vergala, Deputy Commissioner for the Market Assurance Division. Current law, basically about half of the products that are sold in Minnesota are already filed in use products, primarily in the commercial PNC world. What we did is we looked at the filings that were currently prior approval, and we identified the filings where we weren't objecting much. The companies knew what the law required, and so they were pretty much pro forma reviews. Those are the ones we identified to add to the filing use regimen. We are continuing to remain prior approval for workers' compensation, annuities, and most of the health lines. Those are the lines where our folks do spend a lot of time going back and forth with the companies, reminding them about the standards that Minnesota law requires. In terms of total number of filings, I'll have to get you an exact number. One of the other reasons we made the change recommendation is that the total number of filings has gone down, and especially on the life side, we would expect they're going to go down even further as the Interstate Compact gets more and more standards up and running. So we're retaining our ability to do prior approval in the lines where we have a lot of work, and we're going to do back-end work to be sure that the filings that are filed in use actually are consistent with what we expect they're going to be.
Mr. Chair. My observation, they're a little like, you know, setting wild animals loose, though, without if we don't take a look at them, it's sort of a sea change, and I just want to make sure that folks understand what we're talking about here. But the other question that I had was on the unclaimed property. It maybe I didn't read it right, Mr. Junkie, but it said after a year, things go to, if it's in a safe deposit box or some sort of good or something like that, it's sold at public auction. Stock is sold, is liquidated after a year. Then the proceeds from both the auction and the stock sale are deposited in the general fund until claimed by the rightful owner. So do we ever do anything with that, or is there stuff sitting in there since like 1885 or something that's been sitting in the general fund waiting for the rightful owner to knock on your door?
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkin, there are items that are very old. I mean, as that says, those items that have been sold, we don't have the physical goods anymore, but the dollars remain there and sit in the general fund, and folks can claim that in perpetuity. So, I mean, your great-great-grandpa had something and you're the heir, you can fill out the appropriate paperwork and claim that.
Mr. Jackie, I think that's pretty cool, but if I'm doing the math right, that's about $344 million in unclaimed property remitted to commerce just in the last 4 or 5 years. Am I doing the math right? So we got like a gazillion dollars sitting in a stash somewhere waiting for me to come and claim my great-grandfather's inheritance or something?
Representative Atkins is sounding a little bit like the Social Security lockbox.
Mr. Chair, I just got this email. I thought it was in Nigeria. All I had to do was send them my Social Security number and my bank account, and I'm good to go. But apparently, Mr. Junkie's got it.
Mr. Jackie, Representative Hilty and Representative Atkins. It is in the general fund, but it is not cumulative. I mean, the money is there, and I think it gets spent on other things. There's not the Department of or MMB doesn't have anything set aside like the cash flow account where all this goes. I mean, it goes into the general pot, and they make estimates, I think, as to what they feel like will get spent out of that money, and the claims. I mean, from the slides from the other day, there's historically we pay out much less than what we use for other programs.
If I could just request, Mr. Chair, that somebody, whether it's you, Mr. Jenker, or whomever would administer that they could sort of give me the snapshot of what's in there, what's not in there, rather than belabor it all afternoon and talk about it. But I appreciate your follow-up.
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
One last slide, Mr. Chair. It's the fiscal 9 unallotment. I believe you'd asked for some information on that as well. For fiscal 9, the department was asked for $500,000 to work on the fiscal 9 hole. There is three pots of money in which that was taken. First is in the Office of Energy Security. There's a rural wind energy program that we take $250,000, move to the general fund, or return to the general fund. The second is in the market assurance area. Take about $110,000 of uncommitted carry forward. Kind of saw the fiscal 9 problem coming and did not commit those funds in anticipation of this. And then the third area is in administrative services. The shift that I talked about earlier in moving some staff to our indirect cost account, we're going to do that now early this year, and then we'll transfer that savings to or cancel it back to the general fund, and that's $140,000.
Jackie, what is the status of the rural wind energy account? Is there still funds,
Mr. Chair,
available?
I'm not the expert on it, but I'll give you a the basics that I know, and if you like more, we can get somebody down here to talk about it. But I understand we've been working with the folks that are administering this. Well, they're not happy about it, but I think they understand. They've received some money, some outside money as well, to complete the project, and they are stating that they have funding through the end of June 2010, which is when the money here would be set to go away as well. So they're making plans to and feel like they can deliver the program without this $250,000.
Thank you.
Members, are there questions for Mr. Janke? Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, I want to apologize to you for being late. I was at a Green Jobs meeting, and I think I came in just as Representative Knuth was finishing her comment about the new employee orientation cuts. In the State Government Finance Committee, Mr. Janke, you know, we've been looking pretty in depth at the internal controls and internal audit challenges that have been across almost every state agency, and I would say the Department of Commerce is a notable outlier. Both Commissioner Hansen and I use the term in describing each of your employees as fully buttoned up. So, but one of the things that we've identified is not as critical to strong internal controls is not just leadership at the top, it's not just the policy, it's actual ownership as each employee comes on of that process. I would hate to see the outlier for excellence turn into a sort of mid-level and start having concerns about the $3.25 billion that run through your agency. I think that that's a really unwise move, and hope that we can find other ways to find the resources we need to balance this budget without losing that strong ethic that comes especially by training of those new employees.
Anything further from members at this time? Mr. Jockey?
Nope. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And next on the agenda, we have Dr. Harrell from the Public Utilities Commission. Mr. Harrell, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, yes. We ask Dr. Harrell to give both a brief overview of the commission's activities, as Ms. White alluded to earlier, and also a run-through of the budget recommendations, which shouldn't really take long.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to be with you today. I hope you all have a copy of the slides that we have. We're hitting the now. There we go. Thank you. I want to talk to you a little bit about the role of the Public Utilities Commission. Many of you are veterans, so you know this pretty well. It's kind of the drill, but some of you actually are new, so hopefully this will be informative. I also want to talk a bit about the our budget proposal for the upcoming biennium. The commission regulates three very critical industries for the state of Minnesota: retail electricity, retail natural gas, and local telephone service.
Just a second, sure. Representative Beard.
Yes, Dr. Harrell mentioned that this slide presentation, is that not in our packets, or can we don't have that? Should we just take careful notes, I guess, then? Or?
I have a few handouts.
year.
I'm sorry, I didn't realize that they weren't in all of past.
Yeah, no, we don't have them here. All I've got is the budget stuff. And it was the same with the last presentation, too. We had the budget recommendations, but the PowerPoint slide presentation was missing. So, thanks.
We'll see that you get that representative here.
I don't speed write, Dr. Harl, so I'll be taking this.
Okay. As I was saying, the commission regulates three cornerstone retail service industries for the state of Minnesota. And as you can see, the gross operating revenues for these industries are substantial, so a significant part of the economy. Our statutory mission can be found in various statutes. Basically, they fall into three categories. Ensure safe, adequate, and reliable services, utility and telephone services at fair and reasonable rates. Also, as of 2005, the Commission transferred authority for the approval of large energy facilities in the state to the Commission. And also, the Commission is responsible for regulation of telephone services and particularly fostering effective competition for those services in the state. We have certain core functions that are identified here. As I mentioned, just and reasonable rates in terms of service, that's probably was our first and foremost statutory mission and remains a primary goal, primary function. Approval of large energy infrastructure that enhances the public interest. Establishing broad policies that help to regulate the telephone and utility industries in the state that really help to implement the statutory provisions that you all pass into law. Resolving party-to-party disputes. There are occasions where utility companies will have differences, for example, over service territories, or particularly in the telephone area where we have a much, much greater degree of competition. Companies will come in with differences, competitive differences that the Commission is oftentimes called upon to resolve. So we get to wear that hat periodically. We also have a Consumer Affairs Office that mediates consumer complaints. We've increasingly been providing serve as a forum for discussion of issues relating to utility regulation, energy issues, and so on. And also, increasingly in recent years, we have taken on the responsibility of representing Minnesota's interests in regional and national forums. There was some discussion earlier about the Midwest ISO and their many faceted activities. Well, our commission is very, very much involved in their activities as well as other similar types of activities. The structure of the commission is pretty straightforward. We have five commissioners, no more than three from one party, appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate. Our current commissioners are listed here, giving you the web address for more information about the commissioners if you're interested. The commission is structured to have a very significant degree of independence. The idea is to have a body that has independent decision-making authority, but yet significant accountability is also part of that responsibility. As noted here, some of the ways in which the independent authority is conferred is commissioners can only be removed for cause. They are appointed to six-year staggered terms. And then in terms of accountability, they are held to fairly unique standards of conduct. Again, listed several of the major aspects of that. All meetings and deliberations are in public meetings and open meetings. Decisions must be in writing based on a record derived through due process, and it's of course subject to appeal to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. There are restrictions on employment. There are restrictions and prohibitions on communications. Ex parte communications apply, and there's a fairly specific code of conduct that applies to the commission. The commission is somewhat unique as a governmental agency because it really has sort of all three
facets of all three branches of government. It's quasi-judicial in resolving party-to-party disputes, setting specific rates, and so on. It takes on more of a legislative type of role when it sets broad industry policies, primarily through its rulemaking activities, and it also has responsibilities for investigation, consumer complaint mediation, and so on, which really is more administrative in nature. Major issues then affecting our operations. We have a sustained level, a high volume of filings and consumer contracts. Our actual number of filings has probably leveled off a bit in the last few years, but it's still at around 2,000 or just a little bit below that per year. And our consumer contacts per year come in around 17,000 to 18,000. Our workload is more diverse and complex, increasingly so, particularly on the energy side. I might mention that probably the vast majority of our filings are telephone filings, but a large number of those are fairly routine. I'd say that the commission spends a majority of its time on energy matters right now, probably 60-40, somewhere in that range. And certainly the energy issues have become very, very complex, and I'm sure all of you can appreciate that. For example, right now we have four major rate cases that have been filed and are working their way through the process, and we have two that are pending. We've had to sort of negotiate with the utilities involved to waive the 10-month due date on that, because under current law there's a 10-month requirement that the process be completed within 10 months. And with four major rate cases in the House, with the size staff that we have, there's no way that's going to happen in 10 months. So we've had to negotiate with them to extend that period. Also, as I mentioned, the Midwest Independent System Operator, we could have easily three people working on that full time, and we have far from that. Transmission initiatives, there are a number of planning efforts underway that we try to track and we are involved in, and I can tell you more about that if you're interested, but yet another sort of dynamic at work here. We also are working hard with our colleagues at the Department of Commerce to enhance our electronic transparency and ability to manage all of this information. We have established electronic filing and access electronic access to our official records, and I think we have a very, very good system in place to do that. We have a project currently underway with Commerce to enhance that system, to build in more functionality so that it's more usefulness to consumers. We also, as part of that, plan to do electronic service, which will allow us to issue notices, orders, etc., electronically rather than having to spend thousands and thousands of dollars on paper and postage and so on every year, which we do. Also, a major issue affecting our operations is developing staff resources for the long term. A lot of the staff down at the commission look a little like me. They're gray around the or if they have hair, they've been around for a while, which is a wonderful thing because we have very low turnover, a lot of institutional memory, which is a strength, but they are approaching retirement age and we need bench strength. We're working to do that, but it's an issue certainly for us. It's an issue for other state agencies, and I know it's an issue for the utilities as well. But looking at our budget structure then, basically just a very sort of 50,000 foot overview. Our general general fund budget, biennial budget, is 10.9 million. The operations is 5.4 per year. As already mentioned, like the OES, almost 100% of that is recovered for the general fund through our assessment authority. Vast majority of that is salaries and rent. I think salary and rent, if you add the two up, are
comprise about 90% of that total. We're largely a people-oriented, I guess you could say, service delivery agency. We also have a special fund budget, biennial budget, that's $5.5 million. The lion's share of that is the telephone assistance plan, which we administer. This money goes to fund credits that telephone companies provide to low-income families to try and keep telephone service affordable. A very small percentage of that is used to cover part of our personnel costs, but it's just a very small percentage of that. Vast majority are the credits. And then we have also a fund for administrative hearings. This is to cover the costs of the services that we get from the Office of Administrative Hearings. Whenever the Commission has a major proceeding, typically it will refer the matter to the Office of Administrative Hearings for development of the record. And it's the Office of Administrative Hearings that goes out and conducts the public hearings, carries out the evidentiary hearings, develops the record, presents the record back to the Commission. And the Commission then will take that record and the recommendations of the OAH and either accept them or not accept them. Priorities for budget use.
Before you continue, I think we have some questions.
Yep.
Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this goes back to one of the things you were talking about with negotiating with the utilities and the rate cases. And I was just struck by how few employees the Commission has relative to other states of a similar size. Looking at the average in other states is 122, and the Commission staff is 41 or 71 if you add Office of Energy Security staff and regulating, and it's 48th out of the 50 states on per capita basis. And I'm just curious if you could help me understand how that affects your ability to do the work. I mean, energy regulation and utility regulation is very important to the people of the state of Minnesota, and if you could help me understand that better, that'd be great.
Chair, Representative, thank you. It's a challenge, to say the least. We have taken measures to try and streamline our process as much as we can. We've implemented things like consent calendars. We've used technology as much as we can. That's been a huge asset to us in terms of trying to handle the workload. We try to be very rigorous and deliberate about setting priorities, focusing our energies on those cases that have the most impact. But we've reached limits. I think we've reached our limits on this, and we are. The fact that we've had to sit down and negotiate with the utilities to ask them to waive the limit is an indication that we're up against that wall. And there are other indicators, too. Certainly, people are putting in lots of hours, and it's getting to be an issue not only with us. I don't want to speak for the department, but I know they're under the same pressure.
Mr. Hart, could you explain what limits you would be asking utilities to waive?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Yes, I'm sorry. Under current statute, the Commission, when a utility files a rate case, the Commission must complete its process and make a decision on what the final rates in terms of service are going to be within 10 months from the date that the filing is accepted. That's been in place for forever. Given the frequency of rate cases that we're seeing now, given the complexity of rate cases that we are seeing now, because of all of the issues and all of the riders that utilities now have in place, so you've got to track all of those, they're a lot more complicated than they used to be, and it just takes more time. It's not realistic for us to think that we can do it in 10 months. And so that's what we've been compelled to do. We've coordinated with the department and negotiated with the utilities to try and set a schedule. And I'm happy to say that, the negotiations have been productive and we've reached agreement and we've worked out schedules that we think will work. But
you know, it's a rather awkward situation and something that we would prefer not to have to do.
Chair, considering that the commission is operating more or less on a fee-for-service basis, why don't you just add more staff?
Well, Mr. Chair, we did. We did initially think about, contemplate putting in for more, but because of the circumstances that we are all facing, the commission felt it was not the appropriate time to go forward with that, so we withdrew that report.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. I'm just wondering with regards to some of the efficiencies of notification that you mentioned earlier in the slides. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the nature of those notifications that you, it sounded like you were proposing to reduce some of the electronic, through electronics, to save some of those thousands and thousands of dollars. Would this be for notifications on something like, just for example, Enbridge pipelines, that sort of thing? Is that what you're referring to? And then how do you propose to determine which residents are actually going to be able to access electronic notifications? Does your telecommunications branch inform everybody else who can actually get electronics or not?
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for that question. I should have been more careful in explaining this. The notifications that you were referring to were, for example, landowners on a large transmission line or pipeline, so on, would be done pretty much the way they are right now with notifications sent out by the utilities and paper. The kind of thing I'm talking about here would be notification primarily to the parties in a proceeding that have agreed to accept notification electronically. That would have to be part of the arrangement. It's for the usual folks that we deal with. This is really where we're going to get the most savings because they're the ones that we send the most paper to. But it would be the parties who are able to accept it, who have indicated to us they're willing to accept it that way. And it's going to save them a lot of time and everybody a lot of time and energy if we can do it that way. But for those people that are unable to do that or choose not to accept it that way, then we'll send paper.
Yes, Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up with what Representative or Chair Hilke asked, with the waiver of the 90-day requirement, is that you're working with utilities because if they exceeded the 90-day requirement, it was an automatic approval or automatic disapproval of that required or that asked for rate case adjustment?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the 10-month requirement is in the rate case part of the statute, and basically it says if the commission hasn't acted within that 10-month period, the rates are deemed approved as proposed by the company.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I thought that Representative Taylor was going to go in this direction on efficiencies in terms of notification and processing applications, especially route permitting and affected landowners and affected parties. We passed the my provision last year with your assistance, Mr. Chair, which I appreciate, requiring greater notification to local governments affected for route permit siting, hoping to prevent the commission's time for the double time required, for instance, in the Lindstrom case with the XL transmission line, where you had to send them back to the table to do what we could have done had they been brought to the table earlier in the process. It seems to me that that's a real critical piece of the changes we could make to require more notice to affected parties to work things out in advance, which would result in fewer intervening cases, fewer contested cases. Second question, if you could quickly, Mr. Hard, knowing our time is limited, what's your role and how much of the commission staff is engaged in long-term energy planning, so when projects come up, they're compared against that long-term roadmap for the public safety, health, and welfare of the state?
Mr. Har. Mr. Chair, regarding long-term, I agree on the notification. I mean, that's an issue. I agree with what you said on that. I think that's important. We try to be very deliberate about public involvement, public participation, making sure the public understands what's going on to the maximum extent we can.
with, again, with a small staff, there's only so much we can do. We do the best we can. And I know the our counterparts, particularly on the facilities side, where this is usually a bigger issue, that's where the larger number of people, numbers are involved. They also take that task very, very seriously, and they're involved in it as well. As far as the long-term planning is concerned, we have, there are in statute some various planning functions, transmission planning, integrated resource planning, and so on. So those are presented to us, and we rely on our evidentiary process to and the involvement of parties to help us review, help the commission understand all of the nuances of what's being proposed. But that's the extent of the planning that we are able to do at this point. It's basically the established processes, and I say the best examples are transmission planning, integrated resource planning. Some of the activities that we've gotten involved with through the Midwest ISO have taken us into the transmission planning realm, but there it's quite a different ballgame because we're one of 14 states, and 14 states have very different interests, and it gets to be complicated very quickly. So it's a different set of dynamics there for sure. But we're trying to keep all of those plates spinning.
Members, we are just about out of time, and Mr. Chair has a couple more.
Mr. Chair, could I just talk about the change item, the one change item that we have?
We would appreciate that.
Just the most pressing budget needs are, you know, maintaining a strong staff and building a bench strength, as I was saying, keeping our information technology sharp and up to date, because that's really how we do manage our process, but also technical audits and investigations. Increasingly, and this gets us to the initiative, increasingly in recent years, the Commission has come in across situations where it needed specialized knowledge, specialized expertise to examine a particular issue. There, for example, there was an issue a while back with some metering, and no one on our staff, no one on the department staff really had the specialized knowledge to do that. We had to go out and get specialized consulting services to come in and help us evaluate that situation. And there have been other instances like that. And what we're proposing is, and what has been included here as a change item, is a fund that would allow the commission to basically get a loan from MMB when it feels it needs specialized consulting, specialized technical help to evaluate and to develop the record so that it can make an informed decision. That's what we're that's the one change item we have in here. Otherwise it's our standard budget.
Thank you. Members, are there any questions for Mr. Haar at this time? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mr. Pomeroy, what do we have on the agenda for Wednesday?
Mr. Chair, members, the agenda of Wednesday, as you can see on the bottom of our agenda, was not listed. Basically making sure that we got through today's agenda after three or four days in a row of carrying over. But I believe our plan will be to hear from the department and utilities on progress towards a conservation improvement program. So the Senate had a similar hearing last week, I believe, so we'll take that up on Wednesday.
Members, with that, the meeting is adjourned.